Good morning from HPR2, it's The Conversation. I'm Chris Vanderkut. A new WalletHub study ranks the 50 states' most and least fair state tax systems. We'll let you guess where Hawaii ranks. And in the spirit of everything old is new again, we'll hear about a natural farming symposium in Hilo that asks us to learn from what Korea has been doing for centuries.
And I'm Kathy Kozak. University of Hawaii researchers have identified a new species here in the islands, the sleepy orange butterfly. Find out where you can see it and when. And also outdoors, how to save seeds for the future, and why a new library effort in Kailua Kona might just help people to grow their own food.
On Wednesday, September 30th, The Conversation starts right after the news. Welcome to The Conversation. I'm Chris Vanderkut, and Kathy Kozak is here with me. Good morning, Kathy.
Good morning. We've got a lot of great discussions today about living here, paying to live here, being outside, saving culture and nature.
Things that are close to home, things that are right here in our pockets, like our wallets. That's our first discussion. We often hear the term paradise tax applied to our exaggerated cost of living here in Hawaii. And we've mostly benumbed ourselves to the expense without necessarily looking in detail at its causes. WalletHub has looked at tax burdens in its ranking of most and least fair state tax systems, and Hawaii ranks 48th. Jill Gonzalez is a spokesperson for WalletHub, and she has more. Good morning, Jill.
Good morning, Chris. Thanks for having me.
Sure. I guess the first thing to do in talking about most and least fair tax system is defining fair.
Yes, that is exactly what we set out to do first and foremost before conducting the rest of this study. So we asked a nationally representative sample of Americans, when looking at state and local tax systems, what looks the most fair? Then we gave them 10 different levels of income and had them attach percentages to each one. Basically asking them, how much do you think each level should be paying in state and local taxes? And we were surprised to find out that really across the board, between liberals and conservatives, most people agreed that a progressive tax system that imposes higher tax rates on wealthy households than on lower and middle income households was the most fair here.
I was surprised by that too, Jill, because even people with money agreed that a graduated system made the most sense, yeah?
Yeah, that's right. So we had people, again, of various income levels, asked about their own income level as well. They all tended to agree here.
I mean, you would expect people at the low income level, but not so much at the high income level. So it sounds as if there's a pretty accepted notion that the graduated system, that people with more should pay a higher percentage. But what you also found was that most states skew in the opposite direction, yeah?
Yeah, absolutely. So we found that despite what people think and despite people's opinions, the exact opposite is happening. So instead of the lowest 20% spending the least money of their total income towards state and local taxes, and liberals and conservatives agreed here around 2-3%, they're actually spending, this is national average, more like 11% of total income on the state and local tax burden, while the top 1% of earners is spending just 5%, whereas liberals and conservatives agreed on about a 15% tax rate for them.
Well, that's a pretty that's quite a broad distinction, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's hitting some states obviously a lot harder than others. Hawaii is actually one of the worst offenders here. The lowest 20% of earners who are bringing in about less than $18,000 annually spend about 13.5% right on their state and local taxes, whereas the top 1% of earners who are bringing in around $400,000 annually only spend 7% their total income on taxes.
Jill, I've never heard it broken down quite that way, but that figure says an awful lot, doesn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, Hawaii here, especially when we're looking at how much the poor are overtaxed, are the second worst offenders only to Washington State.
The other criterion that you examined is the percentage of state tax revenue that comes from excise taxes, which, of course, fall equally on everyone. And an argument could be made that that's an unfair burden on the lower incomes. You know? It's a bigger chunk of what they have.
Exactly. We found that these states, and Hawaii is, of course, one of them, that really heavily rely on sales and excise taxes, tend to be more regressive and obviously put a much larger burden on these lower-income families than the other states. So that's one of Hawaii's mainly regressive features, so that comparatively high reliance on sales and excise taxes. Plus, the state and local sales tax bases include groceries as well, as many states do not.
You know, what? One thing that emerges from this, Jill, is the possibility that if you were to just be able to have the power to come in and just upend this system and establish progressive taxation and maybe reduce an excise tax burden, you would actually have more state revenue. It would actually be a more effective way, I would think, to run the state, yeah?
Yeah, I mean, there is a progressive system in place in Hawaii. There is that graduated personal income tax structure.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of other things that there is not. So it fails to provide a refundable earned income tax credit, those EITCs that many states are now implementing. And that could a lot of times offset that sales tax, especially when it comes to at least groceries or things like that.
Mm-hmm. So that's a prospective solution. What are some others that could be implemented, you know, in an ideal world would be implemented to kind of right the balance here?
Well, the other thing here, again, one of the most regressive features that a state tax code can have, Hawaii provides preferential income tax rates for income from capital gains, and that, of course, is going to favor the top 20% of earners. So that's another thing that could maybe be changed. I mean, in 2013 and 2014, and, of course, 2015, Hawaii didn't really have any new significant developments in its tax code. So I think maybe looking at this report, it might be time to either change those preferential income tax rates or institute a refundable EITC.
It's a question of getting the information in the report kind of in at the top of public mind, yeah?
Yeah, exactly. And it's not all bad, of course, in Hawaii. Like we said, progressively, it does offer the graduated personal income tax structure. It does limit itemized deductions for upper income taxpayers, and it does have that personal exemption that phases out for upper income taxpayers. So those are a couple of things that help to offset it, but clearly just not enough.
One of your other conclusions was that taxes are slightly fairer in blue states, and of course Hawaii is about as blue as you can get, but doesn't seem to have helped all that much in this case.
No, that is one thing that, of course, we look into, especially among a campaign season like the one that we're entering now.
Mm-hmm.
We did see that there was only a slight difference, although during any debate, I'm sure anyone will tell you it's every little bit counts, but we did see that in blue states, the average rank was about 23, of course, out of 50. In red states, the average rank was 28.
Jill, is this the first time this particular state-by-state analysis has been done?
It is, and it's the first time that we really looked at what Americans believe is fair.
So we're not really in a position to gauge trends, you know, 10 years ago, 5 years ago, that kind of thing.
No, not yet. We are planning on doing this annually, however.
Well, good, because I think it's kind of, we should add that it's based on the public's, the definition of fairness, just circling back to where we were at the beginning. The definition of fairness that you're working from is based on a kind of a public polling of what do citizens think is fair, right?
Yes. The definition is in terms of opinion, but what's actually happening is just based on current tax codes.
Based on what? I'm sorry?
Current tax codes.
Well, I do. It'll be interesting to hear in coming years what your results are, Jill. Thanks very much for taking the time with us this morning.
Thanks for having me.
You bet. Jill Gonzalez is the spokesperson for Wallet Hub, and her take on consumer finance issues has been featured in the New York Times, the Washington Post, and Kiplinger. And from time to time, she talks with us here in Hallway Conversation as well.
This is The Conversation on statewide, member-supported HPR2. It's 8:14. Later in the show, we'll talk about a new kind of banking taking root on Hawaii Island. But first, your quiz.
In today's Backyard Quiz, we're looking at a pivotal event in Hawaii history, an event that ushered in the modern era of land ownership in the islands. Prior to 1848, the year this royal decree was announced, land ownership by individuals was unknown. Foreigners could not own land. But foreign influence was growing rapidly in Hawaii, even as disease was decimating the native-born population. Kamehameha III came under pressure to divide land among the people, land that had formerly been held in common and administered by chiefs and their konohiki, or overseers. He ordered the land divided into four categories: land belonging to the king, land belonging to the ali'i, land that could be purchased by the foreigners who lived in Hawaii, and land worked by the commoners, are Maka Ainana. We're looking for the common name of this historic ruling. We'll be back with it in a half hour. Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets a T-shirt.
Hi, good morning. I'm Betty Guerin from The Greenhouse. You're listening to The Conversation on HPR, Hawaii Public Radio. Join the conversation on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation.
The Hawaii Island Seed Bank has been collecting and saving seeds since 2008 and using the seeds for restoration, research, and mitigation, hoping to preserve the native plants here in the islands. Jill Wagner is an ethnobotanist who has been an essential part of these efforts, and the efforts have attracted the attention of the Kailua Kona Public Library, who have started a different kind of seed bank to help those who want to grow their own plants and vegetables. Jill's on the line to tell us more. Good morning, Jill.
Good morning.
Tell me about the definition of a seed bank.
Well, there are a couple of kinds of seed banks. There are seed banks that hold seeds and store them for long term, for many, many years, over 50 years. And there are short-term seed banks, and I call them working seed banks, that store seed as a resource for doing projects within the 10 to 15-year range.
All right, Jill, I want to make sure we get a chance to hear you well, so talk really close into that phone if you can. Now, as far as what's been going on for a while, you've been really integral in the establishment of a seed bank, looking at trying to save them for the next, 50 years or so. But now there's something exciting happening at the library, and I know you support it. They're going to be having a seed bank available for the general public. How do you go in and check out seeds?
Yes, Natalie and Kipapa at the Kona Library took old an old card catalog and purchase seeds and are offering those seeds for free to the public. Those are food seeds, vegetable seeds that are available to anybody that can just go to the library and take out seed. And the idea is that people grow plants and produce seeds, save some seeds, and bring them back to the library. And so it becomes a cycle in which there's always seed available.
Well, and it certainly sounds like a seed collective. If you like a particular plant or you like a particular herb or you want to grow a vegetable, you know, somebody might have had the seeds for that already available. You can go to the library, you can check them out, and then grow it in the comfort of your own home.
Yes, and the other thing is that when we think about food seeds in Hawaii, virtually all seed comes from the mainland. So one of the things that we're really thinking about is developing seed that's adapted to Hawaii, to the Hawaiian Islands. And so when we grow seed and it does well for us, if we save some of those seeds, then we can grow it again. And if we keep getting good plants, then we start getting plants that are adapted to Hawaiian environments. And that's very important. We depend on mainland seed that's not really adapted for Hawaii. So one of the things about this project is to work on developing vegetable seeds that are actually adapted for Hawaii.
Well, and it certainly sounds like a great idea, because if someone else has already made sure that that plant and the seeds from that plant are the ones that have survived the plant actually establishing root here, then they've already gone through all that trouble. So everyone else can benefit to know which plants are going to survive here because they've already grown. Is this something that you've seen successful already?
No, it just hasn't been done in Hawaii, and it's something we want to develop. And we're working with the Hawaii Public Seed Initiative, Kohala Center, who are trying to get farmers to grow seed. And even if a farmer or someone with a small property or even just a very small container garden grows something, and one species or spinach or basil or whatever they choose and do well with, then they can be part of the community by providing those seeds that are adapted. And it really hasn't happened, and this is very new.
Well, and it sounds like a great model of how communities can come together, learn from one another, grow food locally, because that's certainly a big movement that everyone's trying to take a look at and see if they can do. And then also, I wonder, could you project this going along at other libraries as well?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's a nice model that can be used on all the islands. And the other thing about the seed banking that's very important is that when you have one, source and everybody comes together as a community and supports that by supplying seeds, what you also get is not only the community building, but seed banking is something that needs to be done properly. There's a big difference in the viability of seeds if they're stored properly. So part of this is learning how to store seeds, learning how to clean them and store them, because what happens is if you take seeds and you keep them in just ambient temperatures and you don't dry them properly, their viability will decrease over time. But if you properly dry seeds and package them, their viability will last for much longer. So that's one of the benefits of sharing information, facilities, and being part of something larger than one's own project. And that's what the library and these seed banks can do. On each island we can develop these communities of seed banking.
Well, and it sounds like we're just getting back to basics. If you know how to store seeds, and if you don't, you can learn from your community, from your neighbor. If you know how to do it correctly, then you can be part of this whole initiative for people to be really looking at buying local and trying to grow their own food source and making sure that it's sustainable. So It sounds like you've really tapped into a niche there that's a unique way to look at providing agriculture amongst ourselves. That it's surprising to me that we didn't think about it before. I'm glad that you've really pushed this initiative. Now, you're going to be giving a talk at the library on Saturday, is that right?
That's right, yes.
And is that going to be one of the talks that's going to let people understand how to become part of this collective and how to store seeds?
Yes. I'm going to talk about the Hawaii Island Seed Bank, which is housed at Rogers Ranch, and it's on a off-grid solar system. It's triple backup, and this seed bank is a large walk-in fridge that we use to store all the native seeds that we collect, because we also, as well as the agricultural seed, which is getting started, we do save a lot of native seeds. And so I'm going to talk about the whole project and then tell people about when they collect seeds, how to do it, and how to store the seeds so that you'll have the longest viability. And then they can think about what kind of food seeds they want to try and grow and do it. We'll try to make it as easy as possible for people to get started with it.
Fantastic. Well, thanks for sharing more about that with us today, Jill. I'm sure it's going to be successful, and I hope we can make it go island-wide.
Thank you.
All right. Jill Wagner is an ethnobotanist who earned her degree from the University of Hawaii at Hilo. She's taught Hawaiian horticulture, restoration, and taxonomy for many years. She grows native Hawaiian species for forest restoration and is a garden designer. In her free time, she's also the project coordinator for the Hawaii Island Seed Bank, and will be giving that lecture on seed banking this Saturday. More information on hpr2.org.
Ferdinand the Bull has been many things to many people since the children's book was published in 1936.
The Disney animators took Ferdinand and really feminized the character. He was rounder, he had bigger eyes, longer eyelashes. A lot of people saw Ferdinand as gay.
I'm Sarah McConnell. Join me for With Good Reason, Thursdays at 6:30 on Hawaii Public Radio.
Early gifts for the station's fall drive support the purchase and creation of the programming you listen to every day, as well as the broadcast infrastructure that delivers it to you. Mahalo to Michael and Laura Cowell of Honolulu, Kevin Ahern of Kaneohe, and Carolyn Carley of Honolulu. Thank you for your early gifts. You can make today a good time for your personal gift of support and become a first-time giver at the $10 a month sustaining member level. Please call 955-8821 during business hours, or you can donate online at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for The Conversation comes from Mattson, proud to help fund construction of the American Cancer Society's Hope Lodge in Hawaii, a place for Hawaii's cancer patients and their caregivers to stay. Learn more about Mattson's giving at mattson.com.
Who enforces the law on the high seas? The disappearance of a marine biologist with Hawaii ties aboard a Panamanian-registered fishing vessel has raised that question yet again. His job on board the vessel involved reporting violations of the law, and it's a job that has been known to put embedded observers at risk. Chad Blair has more in today's Civil Beat Reality Check. Good morning, Chad.
Good morning, Chris.
Violations of the law, or alleged violations of the law on the high seas, kind of fall into this gray area of who enforces them, don't they?
Well, you know, crimes can go unseen out there in international waters. People can be thrown overboard. And how are you ever going to find out about it unless somebody, you know, shares that information?
Exactly.
This story by our Nick Gruby is about a man named Keith Davis. And he's the American marine biologist. And he disappeared earlier this month, about 500 miles off the coast of Peru. And his family and colleagues are very frustrated because they can't seem to get more information. The authorities are investigated. That includes the Coast Guard and the FBI. But trying to find out what happened on a boat with only a handful of people is a very difficult situation. By the way, there was a memorial held for Keith Davis just last week at Magic Island.
And, you know, Chad, when you say the authorities are investigating, the question becomes whose authority and what do they have authority over, right?
Right. And so not only with Keith Davis counting fish and recording scientific data, but as you say, he's also making sure or was making sure that the captain and crew are following the rules and regulations, particularly concerning, you know, threatened and endangered species. I mean, what if you're shark finning or something like that? As you know, that's a serious problem. But there's really no way to report these violations if someone disappears. Having an observer on board a ship can cause tension between the observer and the captain and the crew. And in Nick's story, he actually shares a few tales from other observers who have experience being chased by someone with a meat cleaver. Another person had to lock themselves in a bathroom in order to avoid an unpleasant crew member. It's a very serious business. It's very dangerous, a very hard profession, and there can be intimidation involved.
And there's little reason for the crew of a fishing vessel to welcome somebody who comes on board to, in effect, diminish the amount of their catch, right?
That's exactly right. We're talking about big money here. And you know, Keith Davis is described as the kind of person who just doesn't – he's not the kind of guy that's just going to fall off a boat. He's described as very resourceful, sort of a MacGyver type, able to handle himself, certainly comfortable at sea, a lot of experience. But if you're up against people that are in it for the money, in it for greed, well, we can see how that might actually influence a bad outcome.
Well, an awful lot of the area of the Earth is essentially unpatrolled and a potential revenue source for who knows who, right?
Right. And I can tell you that other observers, groups have talked about having some sort of maybe a panic button that the person can push when they're in danger, maybe have some sort of satellite communications to let people know that there's a problem. Those are the kind of things that could avoid such a situation. When we find out more about what happened with Keith Davis, we'll be sure to let you know.
Thanks very much, Chad. The perils of the high seas.
Yes, exactly.
Chad Blair is the political reporter for CivilBeat.com.
I'm Ryan Ozawa.
And I'm Bert Lum.
Today on Bite Marks Cafe, we'll get an update on unmanned aircraft systems and their applications in Hawaii.
How can the technology be commercialized, and how can would-be drone pilots get certified and learn best practices?
That's today at 5 on Bite Marks Cafe.
And you're back with the conversation on HPR2. I'm Chris Vandercook. How many of the solutions for contemporary problems might have been around for hundreds of years? It's a pattern we see repeated again and again. And as people pay more and more attention to the way their food is grown and prepared, many turn to centuries-old practices like Korean natural farming. Jackie Prell is the organizer of a symposium that starts later this week on Korean natural farming in Hilo. She's on the line from there this morning. Good morning, Jackie.
Good morning, Chris.
This is obviously something that's going to be unfamiliar to quite a few of our listeners. And my understanding of it involves using a lot of, well, bypassing the use of pesticides with a lot of natural organisms.
That's right. Just to give you a little of my own history, Chris, about 7 or 8 years ago, my husband and I bought a property north of Hilo. It was old sugarcane land. And my husband is a premier organic farmer. He makes compost piles the size of a small house regularly.
Jackie, let me interrupt you for just a second. I'm not hearing you very well, so can you really kind of really address that phone so that
I'm sorry, Chris. Yes. Is that better?
Yes, it is. Anything you can do to kind of pump the sound in on your end.
Sure,
but anyway, your husband is an organic farmer, and?
He's an organic farmer. 8 years ago, we bought a property. It was Old Cane Land, north of Hilo. And in spite of, you know, our best efforts, our crops were not thriving. We were getting a mosaic on our taro and just not happy with the condition of the soil. The soil didn't have that wonderful tilt and smell. It had more of a quality of sand almost, just from a century of, you know, pesticides and fungicides being used on it and over tillage. And that's when we found out about Korean natural farming and began practicing it. And the results were almost immediate. It was as if you could see changes happening overnight almost. And that's when we really fell in love with the Korean natural farming and began practicing it and sharing it and actively involved in it.
Well, Jackie, you just used a term, a word whose meaning I only learned 5 minutes ago, which is tilth, which is one of the qualities of soil. Would you help us define that?
Well, tilth is that quality of soil where it holds together. It has it has a soil structure that that makes it not susceptible to erosion. It's able to it's that quality where you pick it up in your hand and it, you know, holds together rather than just crumbling like dirt crumbling to the ground.
Because you were saying when you first got to your land on the Big Island that it was sandy, so that effect, when you picked it up in your hand, you could tell it wasn't that great, right?
We could, yeah.
So I didn't mean to divert you. You were sort of saying that that there are ways in which the soil can be made to kind of regenerate itself if you leave the pesticides out of the equation?
If you leave the pesticides out, which we do, we don't use pesticides, but also what the Korean natural farming does is it cultures the microbes and enlivens the soil with microbial life. There's mycorrhizae in healthy soil that have a symbiotic relationship with the soil and the plant. And they take nutrients from the soil and digest them into nutrients that the plants can use. And they also take carbon from plants and sequester it in the soil. So healthy soil is this really valuable resource on the earth, in that it can sequester more carbon than all of the trees on the planet.
So these microorganisms sort of act as a very necessary kind of conduit of nutrients both ways, right? Nutrients
That's
one
right.
way, carbon the other way?
That's right.
So you need soil that is rich with microorganisms of various kinds, and there are several different ones in play here, right?
Yeah, there are. And what's unique about the Korean natural farming is you can go to a store and you can buy fertilizers with microbes and mycorrhizae in it. But with the Korean natural farming, you are culturing and cultivating the indigenous microorganisms, which have adapted over millennia to be the strongest microorganisms for your specific location. So, you know, we have microorganisms that can handle the downpours of Hilo, here in Hilo.
Mm-hmm.
And then the Kona side has other similar microorganisms that like the dry, like the sun more.
But they would be actually rather, they would have evolved in a very different way because of their environment.
Right. The other thing unique about the Korean natural farming is it's meant to be practiced rather than commercialized. It's meant to be practiced by the farmers or by cooperatives of farmers who make all of these inputs with plant material, with waste products like fish waste, fresh fish waste, and so it's all very cheap, very effective, and very efficient.
It sounds as if all the materials you need are kind of already at hand.
That's right, they are. In Korea, they grow a lot of rice, and they use rice bran as the substrate to grow the mycorrhizae on. Here, we don't have a lot of rice bran, so we've been using wheat meal run as that substrate. And now that the mill has closed on Oahu, we're experimenting. Everybody's experimenting with other substrates, but that's still kind of the cornerstone of the Korean natural farming, is creating this compost that's very rich in microorganisms, mycorrhizae that you spread on your soil and mulch. And then we also use biochar and a lot of different very dilute sprays that we make ourselves also to encourage just a friendly bacterial growth and also to give the plants the nutrients they need at certain parts of the plant's life cycle.
It certainly sounds very self-sustaining, self-contained in ways that make a lot of sense, Jackie. Thanks very much for talking with us.
And
Jackie Prell is a sponsor of the National Farming Symposium 2015, sponsored by the Hawaii's Farmers Union United East Hawaii chapter. It starts tomorrow, runs through Saturday at the Komohana Research Extension Center in Hilo. You can find out more on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page.
Hi, good morning. I'm Chris Pierce from The Joy of Sake. You're listening to The Conversation on HPR2. Find out more about the show at hawaiipublicradio.org/theconversation.
In today's backyard quiz, we thought about the 1848 land division that ended forever Hawaii's traditional system of land use and replaced it with private ownership. It divided land among the crown, the ali'i, commoners, and foreigners who were now able to own land in Hawaii for the first time. It was enacted by Kamehameha III under pressure from foreign advisors who wanted to be able to consolidate their holdings in the islands. The land division had an unintended consequence. Relatively few commoners took advantage of the new law. About 8,000 of them received parcels of about 2.5 acres each, less than 1% of the total lands. Many Hawaiians fell into debt and saw their parcels auctioned off. It was one of the great upheavals of Hawaiian history, and it is remembered today as the Great Mahele.
And Kathy Leighton-Hind of Kamauela on Hawaii Island knew that. And congratulations, Leighton. You will win an HPR T-shirt. And at 8:46, that's today's quiz. If you have one, you can send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Achieve 3000, a literacy program used by Hawaii students in grades 2 through 12, offering Home Edition, an online tool to help parents engage in the learning process. Achieve3000.com/Hawaii Parents.
Every once in a while, a new species is discovered here in the islands. Given the potential for damage to native plants and trees, it's not always good news. Daniel Rubinoff, professor of entomology and director of the University of Hawaii Insect Museum in the College of Tropical Agriculture, and his colleagues have discovered a new beautiful insect, the sleepy orange butterfly, that has found a home here in the islands. He's on the line to tell us more. Good morning, Daniel.
Good morning.
Tell me a little bit about the sleepy orange butterfly.
Well, from an entomologist perspective, it's pretty neat. It's a relatively common butterfly across the southern tier of the United States, and it occurs all the way down to Brazil. But collectors will find it all the way north to Canada on rare occasions where it strays in the summertime. So it's not a terribly unusual butterfly from a North American perspective, but it has never been seen before in Hawaii.
Now, how did we find it? I mean, butterflies are so fleeting in their lifespan, and they're generally hard to catch. Who discovered it, and what did you do after that?
Well, actually, it was discovered by Mr. McGough, a resident of the North Shore on Oahu, who happened to notice the adults and some of the pupae hanging around, I guess, in his house or somewhere near that, and he reported that to the Hawaii Department of Agriculture. And they started working on identifying it. And over the process of over a year, we worked with them and figured out that it's pretty widespread in the islands. Almost instantly, we started looking for it and realized it had gotten everywhere.
Now, is that a problem that it's come so far and taken root here?
It, in and of itself, is not a problem. We don't expect this butterfly to cause much significant damage, and it's going to be an innocuous addition to our fauna. But unfortunately, it's more of an indicator of how porous our quarantine is that these kinds of things are arriving. And this is not an inconspicuous one. You know, you can imagine in comparison to some of the significant crop pests that we might have, like scale insects, which are very, very hard to find, should have been relatively easy. And yet, we really can't stop even butterflies from coming in.
So if somebody has, unfortunately, brought this with them inadvertently from the mainland, how would they have done so? Would it have come with some type of fruit or vegetable that had come along with them, or maybe coming from one of the boats? How would it physically have gotten through?
Right, and this is not something we know for sure by any means. In fact, it's a field of study right now, is to really identify the source areas of the invasives we have here and specifically how they're getting here. I would guess that this butterfly probably came in on an agricultural shipment or an ornamental shipment from the mainland, not from somebody trying to carry it in. That would probably not have worked very easily. So it's possible that the chrysalis was hanging on a plant, or a series of chrysalis were hanging on ornamental plants that were brought in. But honestly, that's speculation.
Okay. Well, your best guess. Sure. Okay. And then that might explain why it's on all the islands now.
Right, exactly. The same sort of thing. The sleepy orange, the name is a misnomer. It is not, in fact, a very lazy butterfly, but in fact, a very good disperser. It tends to get around quite a bit on the mainland, and it's traveling from probably South Texas to potentially Colorado and Canada during the summertime. So getting around the islands here was a breeze for it.
Literally, a breeze
exactly.
Would blow it across.
Yeah.
Now, do they do anything good?
They're pretty. They're pretty. They do a little pollination, but I doubt it's significant. And unfortunately, they're also pollinating weeds. I saw them pollinating Wadelia in my backyard this weekend. So
you weren't so happy about that?
Not exactly, no.
So although it's innocuous, it may not take over the space of other native plants and species or insects. It certainly is a harbinger of something that we need to take a closer look at and make sure we don't bring along some other pests in some of our agricultural products. But it looks pretty, and that's all it does, and now you've got some weed whacking to do.
More or less, yeah. We get about 17 new species of insect establishing in Hawaii every year, and not all of them are pests, but we're rolling the dice each and every time. We really need to reduce our reliance on imports and be a little bit more careful about the things that we do import into the state. Making more careful decisions about that would probably help us a lot.
17 new species each year.
Yeah.
That seems like a lot of...
It sure is.
A
we
lot
are the
of potential.
The capital of the world. Hawaii has more things coming in from other places than anywhere else.
You know, we've been talking about a couple of different terms for Hawaii, but invasion capital of the world, that's got to be a new one. And certainly it is true because, you know, we do have this series of native plants and vegetables and trees and various sorts of things that have been here in the islands for years. And yet it seems like as time has gone on, we may have a greater number of invasive species than actual native species. And that mix seems like it's almost a never-ending battle.
That's true, yeah, and inevitably it's going to tilt to having more invasive species than native ones. We're already there in many categories.
So what could the average person do to help protect the islands? What could I do?
Right. And again, it's a matter of being a little bit more careful about the things that we purchase. That idea of buying locally really helps in situations like this. And thinking about the things that we're buying. If something is being imported from a long distance away and it's a fresh cut flower or it's produce, it's got a better chance at carrying an insect on it that could become a pest. Obviously, we need to do that to some extent, but how much we do that versus what we can grow here or buy from Hawaii itself, that's the decision we all have to make. And everybody's going to come to a different conclusion about that, but at least being aware of the risks we're taking each and every time to buy something from off-island, that's something everybody can do.
Now, you mentioned that the man who discovered this in his house or in his backyard, he notified a couple of individuals. If somebody sees a species that they're concerned about, what should they do? Call the Department of Agriculture?
Right. They can call the Hawaii Department of Agriculture, certainly, or they can call the University of Hawaii, and we'll send somebody out there to take a look. Specifically, the Hawaii Department of Agriculture is very good about doing that kind of thing, and they have as one of their responsibilities to monitor new species coming in. So they're really aware of these kinds of things.
Well, good. So if we can try and refine how we're purchasing things from the mainland, and we also are on the lookout for something that looks a little unusual to what we're used to, there's a mechanism of how to report that to other people.
Absolutely.
All right. Well, it sounds like we found a great new species who's made their home here, as a lot of us have, as a transplant. But we've got to be careful. This could be a sign of more things to come. Thanks so much for your hard work in discovering the species as it's taken hold here, but also reminding all of us it's everyone's responsibility to take care of the Aina.
It's been my pleasure.
All right. Thank you so much for being on air with us today. Daniel Rubinoff is a professor of entomology whose research focuses on the conservation of native species and the control of invasive ones, which often involves research on the ecology and evolution of species, enhanced by DNA sequencing and fieldwork like he talked about today. This project was done with collaborators Janice Matsunaga, Will Haynes, and Forrest and Kim Starr. Check out a picture of the sleepy orange butterfly on our Facebook page, Hawaii Conversation.
Hi, this is Ray Cruz inviting you to join me tonight from 8 to 10 for Latin Beat. I'll be playing classic Afro-Cuban Latin jazz, Latin big band classics, and share the latest releases in Latin jazz. That's Latin Beat tonight from 8 to 10 here on HBR2, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. See you tonight.
Kathy Kozak has been co-hosting the show with me this week and next, and Kathy, this is an exciting moment in the show when we discover what our theme was. We usually don't know going in, right?
But it seemed really interesting today. A couple of common messages that we've gotten.
Yeah.
Consider growing local, buying local, and trying to find ways to protect our islands by being careful with what we import.
Yeah, because, of course, the history of what has happened with imports to Hawaii is well known and is usually leads, even in the case of an attractive butterfly, can often lead to disastrous results, right?
I think it's funny that it's populating weeds in Daniel Rubinoff's backyard. Just when you think you're safe, weeds are coming your way.
Well, it's a story that's been repeated so many times in Hawaii, but the whole movement toward growing your own food, finding organic ways to produce it, is that clearly that movement is not going away, and it's just we're learning more all the time, usually learning from the past, oddly enough.
It's kind of ironic. We go back to collecting seeds and sharing with our neighbors.
Exactly. It always was a good idea. And that's it for today. Up tomorrow, we'll get reaction to the Kaiser announcement about Maui hospital operations, reaction from Lieutenant Governor Shan Tsutsui.
Plus, we'll have singer-songwriter Mr. Mack share his inspiration and talk about his unique musical style.
We'd like to hear from you. You can call our talkback line and leave us your comments. Here's the number, 808-792-8217. You also can email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Post comments on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation. Tweet us at HI Conversation or BKOZHPR.
If you missed any of this show or want a past one, find them on the HPR2 archive. Links to more information about guests and topics are there, too. Just look under Talk Shows for the conversation. On HPR2.org, I'm Kathy Kozak.
And I'm Chris Vandercook. Meet us again tomorrow morning for more of the conversation.